by, with their crisp uniforms and glittering epaulettes, and couldn't help make the comparison with the surliness of Ashariel's entourage. The command bridge itself was as cavernous as they all were. The yawning interior space was overarched by a great armor-glass vaulted roof, held up by a forest of tall iron columns. It took us several minutes just to walk from the elevator ranks to the tactical station itself. When we finally arrived, it seemed that Perith had already assembled her entire court there. Clusters of advisers and counselors stood in and around the tactical throne's courtyard, murmuring to themselves and consulting data slates. Perith herself, a portly woman dressed in thick, dark blue robes, was in animated discussion with a man in a line admiral's dress uniform. As we approached, she suddenly stopped talking, as if alerted by some sixth sense, and turned to face me.
"Anna Mercer," she said,
holding out both hands in greeting.
"How very good to see you. No longer in Alexei's shadow now, I think."
The warmth in her voice sounded unfeigned. I began to wonder if Mordecai's gut feeling about all this was correct. "Lord High Admiral," I said, taking her hands. "I thank you for receiving me here." She drew close, and I smelled the aroma of something rare and costly on her high collar.
"And how did you know where here was, Chancellor?"
she whispered.
"I'll have to be a little more careful with my staff, I think."
I kept my head close to hers. "I'd have been a poor student," I said softly, "not to have picked up a few tricks." She smiled and let go of my hand.
"You met Ashariel, I hear."
"A man with many cares. He was not receptive when I suggested adding the throne world's survival to the list."
"I have served with Mar-Av over many decades,"
Perith said, ushering me closer to the High Command throne. I was vaguely aware that none of the assembled crowd were paying much attention to either of us. Their attention was reserved for the high roof, with its vista of the naked void outside.
"I know him well. He's a brute. Rude as a galley serf, with the manners of a grox herder. I never found a way to get much useful out of him by argument. In the end, I decided it was easier to work around him."
"When he was a general, that might have been an option," I said. "Now there are fewer routes to the summit." Perith shot me an amused look.
"So you came to me instead. You wish to embarrass him by getting what you need from the Navy. And what would that be? A few squadrons of Valkyries to put out your fires? Marauder wings to level your recalcitrant habzones? I don't have much more than that left to me. The Primarch, throne bless his coming, has stripped the canister vault bare."
"You have no idea how often I'm told that," I said ruefully. "But we can't do nothing. Perhaps it is not obvious from up here, but our grip on order remains fragile."
"Oh, it's obvious enough. I have lost contact with 9 of our supply depots on the far side of the globe. Any of my predecessors would have resigned in shame for that alone. And it is merely the least of my troubles. But you picked a good hour to meet me here. I had assumed you had done so deliberately, but I sense from your questions that this is more likely a happy accident."
The crowd around us began to become agitated. I wasn't sure what she meant by that, but feared she was right. Something was taking place here that I hadn't known about. Control of information was my greatest and only real weapon, and so to have slipped up on that subject was a wounding charge. "There are no accidents," I said, putting on a brave face, "happy or otherwise."
"Then your timing is excellent, and you have chosen the best vantage for the view. Have you ever seen it before, from the void?"
"Not from the void," I extemporized, wondering how long I could keep this up.
"Then brace yourself, Chancellor. If you had genuine worries over the Primarch's concern for his father's world, this might help allay them."
I did not have much time to prepare. In truth, it would not have mattered much if I had done. I looked up, I looked out, following the movement of the crowds around me, and began to see the void move. In my life of service, I have seen many starships, and for all their size and grandeur, I had begun to become used to them. They were merely vehicles, albeit of a refined and immense sort. Even a Leviathan like the Excelsis Crew was, at base, a means from getting guns from point to point. I admit that I had become jaded, as all who dwell under the shadow of the Senatorum's mouldering colossus probably do. It should have been a relief to find that I was still capable of awe. And for a moment, I wasn't even sure what I was looking at. I initially thought that the armor glass was suffering some kind of distortion. I saw stars go out and had a moment of sudden panic, as if I had been tricked up here just in time to witness the final unraveling. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw figures and schemers running down auger lenses, and discounted them instantly as nothing, nothing at all, could possibly generate numbers of such magnitude. And then, from the darkness, I saw the sunlight catch the first spire and realized that it was coming at us from beyond the world's night shadow, surging out of oblivion like a new terror from the old. The spires kept coming, one after the other, joining up and deepening and stretching into webs of gold and glass and steel. I saw the faces of what looked like cathedrals, piled atop one another, over and over, until the detail became lost in the sheer size of it all. I saw a great ridge, geological in its extension, studded and crusted with ironwork, culminating in twin spires from which fires burned like beacons. I saw the thunder of red suns flaring under canopies of adamantine stalactites, buoying the docking bays and manufactoria and armories and forges, piled and locked together just as the non-artificial worlds of our Imperium were ordained. Only this had been built from nothing by the hand of humanity, cast in an epoch of giants, when no feat was deemed above our limitless capability. And even then, while I struggled to keep my jaw from falling slack, I could see the signs of catastrophic damage along its mountainous exterior. An entire flank, spanning a volume of space I could not even begin to guess at, had been driven in and was leaking gases into the void. The upper reaches of the structure were still lit and occupied, but much else was dark, marred with the filigree of bent steel rods about the moor-like entrance to ordnance chasms. I let my eyes lose focus and gained the impression of a single grizzled face, an ancient and defeated battle god, ravaged by some war beyond imagination, rising to face the sun for one last time, magnificent even in disarray, an old beard straggling out into the emptiness, old eyes blazing with the defiant crimson of senility and fury.
"Phalanx,"
said Perith simply. That broke the spell, and I saw it again as it was. Our peerless star fortress, greatest and oldest of the war machines we still commanded.
"How long have you known?"
I murmured.
"The regent ordered it,"
she replied.
"And such fleet movements, as you know, come under my purview."
I found that hard to believe. Phalanx had long been claimed by the Imperial Fists chapter of Space Marines, who used it, in effect, as their fortress monastery. I had always been led to believe that its deployment was a matter for them alone. Perhaps that was naive. Its power was so unmatched that even a first founding chapter would have been under considerable pressure to use it in defense of the Imperium's most pressing concerns. Maybe Perith had been instrumental in bringing it back to Terra, following Gilliman's command. Maybe she was merely claiming the honor, knowing that the Adeptus Astartes would never make a similar claim of their own. None of that mattered. I had wished for aid, and now I had it. I had wished for power, something to cowl the insurrectionists with, and now I had it. I had wished for a statement, one that would kindle hope in those who had begun to believe none remained, and I could hardly have come up with a greater inspiration. And yet, as I saw it track steadily across the heavens, wreathed in ash clouds and vapour trails, I saw the full extent of the damage wrought upon it, and wondered just what could possibly have delivered such punishment. If Phalanx had come home, was it to stand guard over us, as Perith insinuated? Or was it because it was running before a greater storm, finding the only harbour capable of holding it before its hungry pursuers caught up? But those were questions for another day. In that moment, I remained captivated by the spectacle, both daunted and inspired. Only one question remained for that hour, the one that was always on my lips, the product of my work and the place in which I conducted it. "Who else knows?" I asked.
Chapter 8. Valerian. Of course we had known. When I say we, I mean our order. I personally had not been privy to the information. The Solar Watch, though, made it their business to understand every movement of every vessel within the limits of our planetary system, and so they had long awaited its return from the cataclysm of distant Cadia. Even on the eve of its appearance in our skies, like some giant red star glimpsed from our observatories, many facts were not clearly understood. We knew it had been dispatched to the Eyes Liga in the final weeks of the doomed defence. No doubt it had formed the linchpin of the last battles there before being forced to withdraw. No doubt its occupants had done their best against the despoilers' hordes. For most of its long life, Phalanx had resided within the Sol system, or close to it. The records of its involvement during the Great Heresy itself are sketchy and poorly understood, but I struggle to believe that it was not involved in some way, taking the fight to the fleets of the arch-traitor and bringing its uniquely powerful arsenal to bear. The fact that it had been used ever since by the Sons of Dawn indicated that it must have been pivotal, for the Imperial Fists were not sentimental about discarding weapons that had been proven to have no use. Being a component of Terra's standing defences and being manned by Adeptus Astartes made Phalanx of great interest to us. I had heard tentative voices raised in our councils suggesting that it should be taken over by the 10,000, the reasoning being that a single chapter of Space Marines, no matter how storied, could not possibly hope to man and maintain a machine that had been over-large even for the 7th Legion in its prime. I myself thought that view vain and foolish. We were hardly in a position to take on such a fortress, and the very suggestion of attempting it would have swiftly led to strife we could scarce have lived with. If there were a case for reassignment, then it would have been to the Imperial Navy, who alone had the manpower to fill its corridors adequately. Even the Navy, though, would have struggled with the greatest task before any of us, to understand it. Like so much else that had been inherited from the dawn of our galactic ascendancy, it had become a mystery, maintained in large part on a basis of guesswork, superstition, and idle luck. Do not suggest at this juncture that the Mechanicus would have done a better job. Those charlatans were running out of time even within their own fiefs, and had no business extending their tendrils further into areas they knew even less about. But I digress. Phalanx was here, and that changed things. When I first heard the news, I believed it would alter little, since the enemies we were engaged to destroy were not the sort to be deterred by a void fortress built to lay waste to entire star fleets. By then, I and my chamber were preparing to strike another target, this time further out from the palace. I had been disquieted by the limited evidence we had uncovered of significant forces at work alongside those of the splintered we had known about, and had intended to seek more information about them. I confess to feeling a certain frustration at the pace of reconstruction and reconquest. Our freedom to act in terms of the laws that bound us was greater than ever, and yet we were no closer to extinguishing the fires of rebellion than we had been during the days of blindness. A curious inertia seemed to have colonized the highest levels of Terran government, as if we were all mortal children, given license to explore the world beyond our doorway, yet still lingering under the threshold and peering into the night. I remembered the Heartspite, and I remembered Alea. I wished for that again, even as I understood that it was a different species of weakness to do so. Just before giving the order to strike out into the city again, I had a summons. This was not one I could have delayed responding to, for it came from Trajan Valoris, the Captain General of my order. I told my counterparts in the chamber to wait for me, and made my way to the summit of the tower. I had not been aware that Valoris was even on the throne world. He had been occupied with many campaigns since the start of the crisis, and I knew that he had fought more than once alongside Gilliman. There had been rumours that he would soon accompany the Primarch on a permanent basis, but I had always doubted those. Valoris was a High Lord himself, and his duties were far more tightly bound here to Terra than to the many wars of the Deep Void. The chambers he occupied when in the tower were as bleak and spare as any of the rest of them. I often reflected on the mismatch between the magnificence of our battleplate and the crudeness of our dwellings. We went to war clad in some of the finest and most ornate armour imaginable, and yet, when given similar license to adorn the places we trained in, meditated in, and studied in, we chose blank stone and the soft light of candles. The Captain General was no exception. He could have opted to spend his scarce resting time surrounded by pearls and crystal goblets, and yet his rooms were studies in monastic restraint, as cold and dark as a crypt. When I entered them, he was seated. He was in full battle armour, the famed Castellan plate, which glimmered darkly from the light of the candles. He was reading, an official document stamped with the imperial seal and written in ink on parchment. Dozens of other such documents were heaped on a granite-top desk in the corner of the room. I waited for him to finish. Eventually, he set the parchment down, reached for a quill, and signed his sigil at the base of the document. I saw the flicker as nano-idents within the charged ink activated, sealing his authority into the molecular bindings and making it irrecoverably his. He looked up. His scars looked livid in the yellow light, only part hidden by his grey beard.
"Hero of the Lion's Gate," he said, "how fares the campaign?"
I was not sure why he used the title. If he were intimating that it was not fitting for one of our kind, then the jibe felt like pettiness. He could have stopped it beforehand, had he wished to. Knowing that, whatever else he might have been, Valoris was not a petty man. I chose to believe that he was merely being formal. "We have barely started, Captain General," I said, "but progress is made." He nodded, a ghost of a smile briefly flickering across his lips.
"And it feels good, does it not, to have the freedom to strike out wherever instinct takes us? Your doing, we must remember. In part, anyway."
"There is no shortage of work for us here."
"True enough."
He pushed his throne back from the desk and rose to his feet. It felt incongruous to witness him there at all, the greatest warrior in our ranks, as if he were some faceless scribe at his copying station. His movements in that place, surrounded by the tools of scholarship, were like those of a caged predator, circumscribed by its prison, but padding up against the confines.
"I shall be here, too, for a while at least. I might curse the day I listened to Chancellor Tyron, were it not clearly my duty to take a place at the high table. So tell me, then, how things stand beyond the walls."
"The state of crisis endures," I said. "We reconquer ground, but too slowly, and recovered sectors are swiftly beleaguered again. The environs of the palace itself are secure from assault, and some dozen urban sectors beyond it. Outside this narrow belt, nothing can be relied upon."
"And why is that? There have been rebellions before. Nothing so long-lasting as this."
I had asked myself the same question many times, and had been unable to come up with an answer that satisfied me. "The psychic shock was profound," I offered. "The enemy planned long for this day, and had forces in place ready to take advantage. Centuries of neglect has left the underhives ready to revolt on the slenderest pretext. And most of all, our resources are limited."
"Due to Indomitus?"
"Yes."
"But that is not all, is it?"
He was right. All these factors were relevant, but hardly sufficient. I had no more answers, though. "Detain the leaders," I said, retreating into platitudes, "and the truth will emerge." Valoris nodded.
"Yet even if our numbers were 10 times what they are, that would take an age. So listen closely. Gilliman did not disregard the throne world before he left it. Phalanx has returned to the Sol system and now stands in orbit above us. something that I trust will calm some nerves among my peers of the Council. You should know, though, that the fortress itself is badly damaged. We are informed by our agents on board that its defensive systems are barely functioning. The bulk of its cargo, refugees from the Cadian War, has already been removed and been assigned to duties elsewhere. Like everything to come out of that disaster, it is a shadow of what it was, and yet it still retains one valuable asset, a company of Imperial Fists, all of whom have been sworn to the defense of their ancestral home.
I was not sure how I felt about that. The Adeptus Astartes had always been a double-edged blade, as likely to inflame a situation as to quell it, but I could see that the news was intended to be welcome, and so did not voice the sentiment.
"They shall be valuable allies," I said.
"More than that," said Valoris.
He looked directly at me.
"They shall be the spear tip on which our recovery depends. They must be seen to win this world back. Do you understand this?"
I did not. I had not given the issue of attribution a moment's thought. It mattered nothing to me where salvation came from, as long as it did, and that our oaths of protection were fulfilled. No doubt, this was some matter of politics, a consideration from the High Lords themselves. If so, I could already see the weakness of it. The greater population of Terra, at least in its higher echelons, held no love for Space Marines. Those Terra troops had always been kept at a distance, ostensibly in distant, myth-wound memory of their depredations during the Great Heresy, but more realistically because they were so hard to control once unleashed. The Imperial Fists had maintained a warkeep here since the days of legend, that was true, but it was of little more than symbolic value, set besides their much more extensive fleet-based holdings. When the Primarch had taken his assembled chapters away with him, the truth was that many here had breathed a sigh of relief. My lack of enthusiasm must have been obvious.
"You brought us out of the shadows at Vorlees," Valoris said. "That had a purpose, one we have embraced. But now we must relearn the value of obscurity. No more ceremonies, no more wreaths. When the populace begs for deliverance, they must pray for the angels of death, just as they have done for 10,000 years.
And there was the criticism, veiled no longer. It stung me a little, given what I thought had changed, but could hardly express that, not here, and not now.
"As you commanded," I said.
Valoris approached me and placed a heavy hand on my shoulder. There was no censure in his expression, just patience, as if he were a lawmaster calmly but firmly repeating a lesson that ought to have been learned a long time ago.
"This world is already fractured," he said. "The cracks will widen. When a power rises or falls, it must never do so claiming our blessing. What you distrust as an old passivity is something deeper, something more subtle. We did not remain behind our walls for those millennia out of timidity, but because we needed to preserve a necessary purity. Remember that. We lose that. We lose everything."
That was the old mantra, repeated again. I recalled how the Primarch had spoken to me, and could not help contrasting the sentiments.
"I understand," I said, hoping that by speaking the words out loud, I would in time come to believe them.
His name was Tor Garadon. He held the rank of captain, the commander of close to 100 battle brothers. I understood he had not held the position for long, at least by the standards of his chapter. As with all our forces in those days, the Imperial Fists' rates of attrition had been heavy, and like so many others, he had been forced to take his place earlier than had otherwise been intended. Of all the Adeptus Astartes, the Sons of Dawn were the ones we knew the most of. The links between the old Seventh Legion and Terra were the closest in all the Imperium, even though their chaptermaster rarely visited the world in person. On occasions in the past, our two institutions had cooperated, but only when necessary and only for short periods of time. This Garadon was typical of his kind, in that he had been fighting almost without pause across a bewildering array of battlefields spread widely over the Imperium. As I reviewed his service record, I found myself reflecting not for the first time on the astonishing resilience of the Space Marines, hurled from one war zone to another without pause, expected at every turn to perform miracles from populations who regarded them as little less than living gods. He had fought against heretic Astartes on Taladorn, followed by the Greenskins in the Magor Rift, after which he assumed control of Phalanx and the battered third company of his chapter. The Star Fort had been assailed before its reconstruction was completed, under circumstances that were left vague in the record, but which must have been close to catastrophic to have delayed its deployment to Cadia for so long. Once Phalanx had finally arrived in the heart of that storm, Garrodin was forced to fight for survival once again, this time accounting for the enemy vessel Will of Eternity, before marshalling the evacuation of the surviving Cadian defenders and delivering them from total ruin. That was a more than impressive tally, a career spent at the heart of some of the greatest battles in the Imperium's history. To the extent that our ranks were comparable, I guess that I outmatched him. In terms of raw combat experience, he far outstripped me. I wondered to what extent that would matter, once we met. I had the opportunity to find out 3 days after my meeting with Valoris. As instructed, I had held back from my own investigations, waiting for Garrodin to take the lead in our ongoing campaign. We arranged to meet, not in the tower, but in the Imperial Fist's own bleak warkeep, the one they had maintained and garrisoned ever since the days of the Great Heresy. I took the Talion, together with the rest of my brothers, and we docked high up the western face of the keep. It was a brutal-looking place, built in the orthodox Imperial Gothic style, and bereft of the old artistry that the tower still preserved. Inside, it was spotlessly clean, of course, and maintained with precision by a small army of serfs and servitors. But every chamber of the place was built for constant training, for constant weapon drills and combat preparation, for the ceaseless prosecution of what they did best. We were met by the Castellan of the keep, a Lieutenant Hessler. That was something of a surprise. I had never come across that rank before among the Adeptus Astartes, though it was common enough elsewhere.
"The Codex Astartes did not escape reform," Hessler explained to me, as we walked from the intake hangar towards the keep strategium.
"The Regent's doing?" I asked. Hessler gave me a wry look.
"More changes will come. You are familiar with the Primaris program?"
I was, though at that stage by reputation only. We knew that Gilliman had raised fresh troops from long-secreted caches on Mars. The successful subterfuge of that enterprise had shaken the agents of the Tower, who had always prided themselves on knowing every clandestine initiative within the Imperium's many factions. The disquiet over the Primaris revelation had been so great on Terra, in fact, that there were those who even now claimed skepticism over whether the whole thing was some kind of elaborate sham, a rushed founding along conventional lines, doomed to expire as the flaws of its gene coding were exposed. Wiser heads knew that such was wishful thinking, and that the Primarch had indeed instigated a profound evolution of the Space Marine. Where that evolution would lead was yet unknown, perhaps even to him.
"Are there any Primaris Marines in your company?" I asked. "Not yet," Hessler said, in a tone of voice that suggested he expected the situation to change.
I could not tell whether that was something he welcomed or not. We reached the strategium, an octagonal chamber set deep within the keep's armoured core. The black walls were inset with dozens of auger lenses, and hololiths glittered over the columns like green-tinged ghosts. The place was forbidding, as if they kept it permanently plunged into combat lighting, and the air smelled faintly of the unguents used to pacify the machine spirits of weaponry. Garrodin was waiting for me. He looked much as I had expected, given what we knew of him, an aristocratic face, refined despite the muscular augmentation he had undergone. His hair was dark, shorn close to a deep bronze complexion. He had the sharp features characteristic of the higher echelons of Callistan society, and regarded the world around him much like one of those fantastically wealthy oligarchs might have done, as if he either owned it, had just sold it, or planned to buy it. Only when he spoke did his more enduring gene lineage make itself obvious. His voice was clipped and gruff, casting the image of, so they said, still all of his kind, the primogenitor himself.
"Shield Captain," he said,
formally, making a cursory sign of the Aquila.
"Captain," I replied. My brothers filed into the chamber, facing off against their opposite numbers. We were like so many golden statues lost in the gloom. Be welcome to Terra. I wished to ask him about Cadia, then. I wished to compare stories of fighting the Black Legion, both to learn from his experience, but also, more simply, to hear how it had been there. In the end, all I said was, I understand you have been briefed on the situation here.
A damned mess, he replied. How did it get so bad?
He was interrogating me. He felt he was owed answers, as if I, personally, were somehow responsible. Amid all the awkwardness, I found this rather amusing. Upheaval across the entire Imperium has been considerable, I said, evenly. Terror has not been spared.
It should have been, he snapped. Hessler here,
he motioned towards his lieutenant,
was at the Forbidden Fortress when it fell apart. Fell apart? Where were you then? Stuck in the palace?
I knew exactly where I had been. We had all been occupied with our many labours on that night, attempting to keep a burning world from exploding entirely. As the days of blindness had begun, I had been travelling towards my first encounter with the Neverborn on Terra, something I shall never forget. Not quite, I said. Garrodon shook his head in irritation.
Then I'll speak plainly, Custodian.
Please do.
This has been reckless. It has been irresponsible. We should have an entire chapter here, more than one.
He was right, of course. I wondered which battleground he would have forfeited, though.
But it ends now, Garrodon went on. Coordinated strike, spread out, rapid intensity. We burn out the ringleaders, send a marker, restore the fear of the throne. They told me you had a list of targets.
Perhaps this aggression was intended to establish some kind of marker here, too, like a beast putting its scent around its territory. I quite admired it. We took a cult leader alive, I said. He has been under interrogation, which gave us information. Our enemy is diffuse, but coordinating. There are numerous leaders, none of which appears to be in overall control of more than a handful of cabals. He gave us names, all of them fanciful or blasphemous. The Convolute, the Master of Dreams, the Lacrimosa. I have the full data with me. You are welcome to place them within your own systems. As I spoke, Ravathane took out our data slabs, wrapped in gold braid and glimmering behind security fields. They were taken by the Imperial Fists, who moved over to a console to begin the process of transfer. Their armor spirits must have been advanced. Within moments I could tell that Garrodon was already processing what we had given them.
Zatasta, he said.
Zatasta was the subsector immediately to the north of Gorgantha, one that had been entirely dark since the beacon's loss. Skrato had indicated that a splintered cabal had gathered in strength there, bringing up weapons from looted depots and forming up into organized divisions. As ever, they were concentrating efforts on ministorum structures. There was a significant basilica in the heart of the subsector, one that we believed was being used by the so-called Convolute as a base of operations. Cleansing that and re-establishing a loyal garrison in its place to serve as a station of supply would open up the prospect of pushing deeper into contested territory. Our experience is that when we can destroy strong points, I said, regular enforcement troops are now capable of occupying and holding the ground. I would suggest, if you concur, immediate and decisive deployment to the epicenter. Garrodon smiled briefly then, a twitch at the corner of his elegant mouth.
You always talk like this.
I believe so, I said, hesitantly.
Throne.
He turned to Hessler.
Two squads, both in Artaxis.
Hessler bowed and withdrew. A number of the Imperial Fists in the chamber followed him. Garrodon reached for his helm.
No reason to delay, then, is there?
After enduring so much talk of caution and restraint from my own people, it was rather good to hear him say that. We took Rastava and boosted clear of the Warkeep just ahead of their own gunship, the Thunderhawk-class vessel they called Artaxis. That was a huge machine, set next to ours, and flew cumbersomely with enormous downdrafts of smoke, but I knew from experience what prodigious destruction it could unload. We both flew hard over the spire tops and tower canopies, taking a direct course towards the target. The day was waning, and the clouds above us looked heavy and stolid. I did not know if Garrodin had had much of a chance to observe Terra at ground level yet. If he had not, I imagined he would have been appalled to see its degradation. With some exceptions, all heavily guarded, the skein of transit ways was still rubble-strewn and dotted with the blackened carcasses of ground cars. The eastern horizon was heavy with lingering pools of smoke, and most of the great Habspires were far darker than they should have been. Close to the immense palace walls, atmospheric traffic had picked up again, but it was not long before it thinned out, replaced by the grinding progress of Militarum convoys. Our adepts had already prepared data screeds on the target, the Basilica of the Agony, a colossal shrine built to commemorate the Emperor's immortal sacrifice. I felt I already knew every centimetre of its tortured, over-elaborate surfaces, the high altars with their mass of twisted imagery, the glossy floors padding with pilgrims, the great bells tolling for the fallen. Of course, it was likely that the interior had been somewhat changed by the current occupants. I imagined the defences would be similar to those we had encountered in Gorgantha, only greater in magnitude. I was to be surprised. The first sign was the great pillar of black smoke on the eastern viewscopes. It was far greater than the many smaller fires burning further out. For a moment, I wondered if a big flyer had come down. But as we closed on the coordinates, it was clear that the basilica itself was the source.
"This is the place," Garrodin voxed from his gunship.
I could understand his confusion. The expected profile of the edifice, a typically vast collection of interlinked towers and domes, was blotted out by the huge rolls and swirls of smoke. As we neared, I could see the central cupola was gone, its surface broken and slender fingers of metal jutting out from around a burning rim. The buildings around it were also badly damaged, and the courtyard in front of the high western gates was blasted and cratered like something out of a battlefield. "It is," I confirmed, running a scan for movement within the rubble. I could detect nothing in the way of a threat, but visual scans were revealing plenty of bodies lying immobile within the piles of blown masonry.
"Then I don't think we're the first to get here," Garrodin said.
We brought both our gunships down before the blackened arch of the main gates. As I disembarked, the only thing I could smell was burning. Burning fuel, burning flesh, burning metal. The destruction was striking. The gate doors were gone, exposing the gutted innards. The high-linked roofs of the basilica had all collapsed, littering the naves and transepts inside with smouldering wreckage. The weak, grey light of Terra's dusk flooded into chambers that had not experienced it since their original construction, illuminating heaps of headless statues and shattered reliquaries. Garrodin came to stand beside me, his bolt pistol drawn. He was looking up at the pillars ahead, all of which had large holes gouged in the stonework.
"You know what those blast marks are?" he asked me.
I did. "We will learn more inside," I said, picking my way through the wreckage and crossing into the acrid interior. Under the still-standing arches, bodies were everywhere. They lay across the shattered stonework or were broken within the charred panels of crushed transports. The splintered had deployed some heavy vehicles in the mournful caverns of the old basilica, but it appeared to have done them little good. I saw more than a dozen immobilized Lehman Russ tanks, most with their turrets ripped clean off. We reached the heart of the great nave, right under the gaping hole of the broken cupola, and saw evidence of some kind of last stand. A row of pulpits had been smashed into kindling, and the marble floor had been cracked and ruptured. The bodies were piled highest here, thrown atop one another as if shoveled by a dozer blade and left to rot. Flies were already thick there, and for the first time human stenches rivaled the bitter palls of burning. Aside from this, the main impression was one of dreadful silence. The combat could not have taken place very long ago. The corpses were still warm, but every echoing void was now quiet again, the only sounds being the crunch of our boots and the crackle of flames. I looked up into the high-arched vaults, now in danger of collapsing entirely, scanning for any lingering trace of those who had done this. Garrodin lumbered past me, went up the steps towards the central altarpiece, and stooped to pick something up. After failing to locate any signs of life or movement above or ahead, I came to join him. He had picked up the remains of something.
"Bolt shell casing," he said, throwing it at me.
I caught it. It was a mere sliver of metal, a scrap of material that had been blasted clear on detonation.
"You told me there were no space marines on Terra."
That had been true, as far as I knew. The evidence was conclusive, though. Even if the residue of the bolters had not been everywhere, the sheer scale of destruction would have pointed in their direction. No other force was quite as ruthlessly capable of causing such immense damage in such a short space of time. I did not know what to tell him. I let the bolt shell fall to the ground and crushed it beneath my heel. "Clearly," I said, as evenly as I could, "I was wrong."
Chapter 9. Alea. So I had my task. I was here, back in the shadows of our old domain, charged to discover why we had ever left it. From a warrior to a historian, Valerian might have approved. I knew the process would not be easy. If the answers had been close to the surface, they would not have been forgotten by so many. So the truth was buried deep, just as it was in so many other places. The Imperium did not produce many souls of distinction, but it had always been good at generating undertakers. The Citadel was, as Asurma had warned me, a strange place. The Fellowship had never occupied more than a small part of it during their long vigil, but had huddled tight within a set of chambers close to ground level, shunning both the catacombs below and the locked halls above. They had lived shabby lives, as far as I could see. It wasn't clear to me how they had amassed the coin they had needed to survive for all that time. However they had done it, the process had left them little more than beggars, subsisting on scraps from the daylight side of Luna. Or perhaps they had been straightforwardly thieves, looting things they did not understand and selling them on to those who relished the touch of age in their trinket hoards. Somehow, though, they had managed to cling on here, a couple of hundred of them, squatting in their hovels, staring at us with a mix of veneration and suspicion. Most appeared to be related to one another, which was another reason to be wary. I did not have the heart to ask Telam whether inbreeding had been a deliberate policy during the empty centuries. I found that I would rather not know. He followed me around like a canid looking for a master. I was not kind to him. I found his attention largely unwelcome, especially the frequent allusions to what I guessed were his religious precepts. Sometimes, when my attention was diverted for some reason or other, I would look up to find that he had been gazing at me, a look of blank adoration on his thin face. On those occasions, I would send him away. I kicked him once as he scurried out. He always came back. That made it worse. I had spent my life trying to get used to aversion. Now I had to get used to someone who just wouldn't go away. Still, he was undeniably helpful in some respects. He understood how many of the old lock systems worked, at least on the lower levels. He knew his way around the inhabited sections of the Great Tower, and I relied on that at the start. The Fellowship had maintained something like archives, and he showed them to me as soon as I asked for them. After a great deal of study, I concluded they were mostly trash, collections of mystical treaties, a mishmash of orthodox propaganda, and some older strains of ritual practices. To the extent the records approached any kind of real history, it was all very recent, the doings of the Lunar government, imprecations against the corrupt port governors, notes of occasional raids by the enforcers looking for stolen artifacts. It was clear that the authorities here knew something of the Citadel's nature, realized it was very old and might contain some material of value, but had not guessed its original historical function. The old fortress had lain here, all through those silent millennia, a haunt of degenerates and half-cocked scavengers. I might have wished it properly erased, rather than suffer this lingering indignity. Asurma and her acolytes were busy too. As I had already discovered, the Citadel's own resources were paltry, but the demand for our services would only grow. 100 or so of my sisters had been billeted here, most as instructors in our ways of physical and psychic combat. One by one, dust-thick chambers were opened up and put back to use. We had to beg the port's officials for resources to bring in engine seers for our power generators, and for Lex mechanics to maintain the rusty cogitator banks that had been lifted from the old depots on Terra. Blackouts were frequent, as were interruptions to our water supply and ration imports. None of that mattered much. The mood among those of us who had returned was one of quiet elation, matched only by a steady determination to make sure this thing succeeded. I conversed with my sisters whenever I could, taking in their many stories of isolation and recovery. There were always some similarities in our various histories. The need for secrecy, the indifference or hostility of the official Imperium institutions, the constant danger of raids or purges. The scattered convents had left us with divergent ways. Even our armour and weaponry were different, maintained under cover by forges short on supplies. I spent many hours studying the ratine plate from distant convents, noting the solutions they had adopted for the environments in which they had fought. Every sister's face was different, a different shape, formed by different gravitational pulls, a different shade caused by variant spectra of sunlight, but in every pair of eyes I saw the same thing reflected back at me. Relief. Relief that now we could gather ourselves together again, protected by the same Imperium that had once hounded us. Relief that we no longer had to live lives of lying and deflection. Relief that we could take solace in our numbers and strength again. Some of my sisters were souls of delight. Others were tedious. A worrying number were deeply religious, to the point of near fanaticism. With all of them, though, to some degree or other, I could be open again. Our conversations must have seemed ludicrous things to any outsider who blundered into them. Dancing fingers, sudden gestures, the occasional snort or laugh. But that was just another shared element that bound us closer together. Such moments of levity were not common, however. Our duties were onerous. I myself spent many hours returning to full physical condition, getting to know the weight and temperament of my new blade in the practice pens. Young girls were arriving all the time for training, most plucked from the holds of black ships, others brought back by expeditions launched by the custodians or our own sisters abroad with the crusade. They would arrive at the citadel in their black shifts, their heads shaved, and the mark of the sisterhood etched on their cheeks, eyes wide and fingers knotted nervously. We were not gentle with them. We could not afford to be. The galaxy was not a gentle place. Many of them we knew would not survive the training process. Those who did so would be like we were, tempered into something harder and colder, ripe to withstand the horrors we had been created to oppose. Amidst all of this, all the new arrivals and the ongoing labour of the pioneers, I had my own work to do. I trawled through every surviving archive and interrogated every member of the Fellowship who was remotely lucid. I struck off on my own, breaking into long-sealed halls and corridors. For some of those journeys I spent hours in isolation, carefully treading through ancient spaces, ankle-deep in dust. Under the sharp starlight of the lunar sky, I prized open barred caskets and hunted for traces of a past life. Every so often, hidden in some crack in the stone or wedged under an ironwork plinth, I would find a reminder that we were only the latest occupants of this place. A devotional amulet, a scrap of parchment with a name on it, the footprint of an armoured boot still visible amid the grime of forgetting. I did not make much progress, though I came to understand a little of the architecture of the citadel itself. It was not like an imperial building at all. Whereas most fortresses of the Imperium had been constructed to a brutal template of uniformity dictated by the old military manuals, this place was like none I had ever encountered. There were few orthogonal edges, and many sweeping curves. Some chambers looked like frozen waterfalls, others like caverns of ice. They were unlit, of course, and so I used my armor lumens to track across the undulating surfaces. The place was not beautiful, at least not conventionally. I found some of the spatial harmonics unsettling, and others vaguely reminiscent of something I could not place, as if from a vision or a dream. On one occasion, I made my way to the very pinnacle, still off-limits to most personnel. It was unsealed to the thin atmosphere, and so I went fully armoured, clambering steadily up through corridors strewn with broken furniture, until I was standing in a single narrow lantern chamber, bordered by tall, iron-veined windows. In all compass directions, I could see the emptiness of Luna running away from me, overarched by the deep black of the sky. The dust plains stretched off far below, so far that I felt I was scraping against the very edge of Luna's atmosphere, an observer on the limit of possibility. I could just make out the light of settlements in those wastes, linked by narrow threads of old transit lanes. They were isolated places, forever sunk into a darkness that never broke. I wondered why they were there, far from the mines and the breakers' yards and the void docks' hinterland, scattered like faded jewels amid a parched emptiness. I turned away from the view and looked down at the wreckage at my feet. Some of the broken objects might have been valuable once, but I saw nothing much that was likely to be repaired or recovered for use. Maybe it had all been shattered during some single cataclysmic event far in the past. Or maybe others had scavenged here over a long period of time, gradually stripping the place of its treasures. I knelt down, letting my fingers drop into the dust. I brushed some of it aside, revealing a black stone floor, inscribed with characters I couldn't understand. Just as elsewhere, the sigils had an uncanny edge to them, so foreign to my sensibilities that they might almost have been Xenos shapes. I spent some time seeing if I could make any kind of sense of them. In the end, I took a Pict and stood up again. We may have been masters of this place once, I thought to myself, but we were not the first. I discovered little else of interest within the Citadel. I began to fear that my time was being wasted. My practice sessions with the Somnus Blade became ever more intensive, as if I could somehow exorcise my frustrations through physical exertion. After one such session, I returned to my chambers alone, my jerkin soaked with sweat. My hair had come loose from its bindings and hung in damp clumps about my face. I reeked. It was not welcome then to see Telam waiting for me outside my chambers. My mood had not been improved by mock combat with drone servitors and dumb obstacles, though it occurred to me that putting a blade through his scrawny chest might give me some fleeting satisfaction. "Go away," I signed, reaching for my door lock. He bowed, offering me a pile of old leather-bound books. "As you commanded me, Lord," he said. I had indeed asked him for those things. Like the faithful hound he was, he had retrieved them. The doors slid open. I went inside and motioned towards a tabletop protruding from the organic sweep of the interior walls. "Leave them there." He followed me in. As he put the books down, he caught sight of the Picts I had taken in the high chamber. "The words of the matriarchs," he said softly. Mostly to himself. I reached for a towel and ran it over my face. "What?" His thin face snapped up guiltily. "The words of the matriarchs," he said again. As so often with him, he had lapsed into a quasi-devotional expression. I looked over at the Picts, seeing the character shapes on the rigid plates. "Can you read these signs?" He shook his head. "We remember some things, but the knowledge fades." I threw the towel into an overflowing laundry hopper. I rebound my hair and went to join him at the table. "Does anyone still read them?" He looked thoughtful for a moment.
I do not think so. Unless maybe the dust kind. The soul knight.
This was the first time I had heard such words, and they sounded irritatingly obtuse. Telam himself did not sound very sure of himself, but then again every scrap might be useful. I remotely activated the pulse shower in the adjoining hygiene chamber, and after a few stuttering coughs, I heard water spurt from the aperture. "Make yourself ready," I said, adding a Banish imperative to the gesture. "Vehicle pull, 30 minutes. You will show me." We took a ground car out from the Citadel. Like all Lunar-made vehicles, it was clunky and robust, designed for a terrain that had only ever been part-tamed. Keeping an atmosphere in place and gravity functioning at something close to usable levels occupied the greater part of the satellite's terraformic infrastructure, meaning that the empty quarters of the satellite's night side had remained, in many sectors, virtually pristine wilderness. We jolted and shook our way across the plains, half lost in a haze of kicked-out dust. I looked back and saw the full height of the tower behind us, rearing up like an impossibly slender mountain from the crags at its base. On Luna, everything was picked out in sharp relief, and I felt then as if I could pick out every flaw and blemish on its surface, preserved forever in this quiet, dark, interminably alien place. We followed old tracks after that, and the faint lumen glow from the Citadel dropped below the horizon. The ground car trundled on, moving now through the perfect dark of the eternal night. Above us was the great curve of the galaxy, far brighter than it had been on Eraser, betraying none of its torture and bloodshed amid the immaculate stellar necklace. After what felt like a very long time, we passed through settlements again. They were mean, poor places. Low-rise, rock-crete habs, fraying at the edges, clustered around comms towers that looked barely functional. I saw men and women sitting in the doorways of domestic units, clad in little more than rags. Some had canisters in their hands that they drank from listlessly. Others looked vacant, with the telltale lethargy of narcotic use. It was a surprise to see such desolation here, right next to humanity's birth world. I knew that on the other side of the Terminator, the press of buildings was just as frantic and compressed as it was on Terra, the urban spread fueled by the churn of industry in the void docks. But this might as well have been another planet entirely. "Has it always been so desolate?" I signed.
"Why would people come?"
Telam replied, concentrating on keeping the ground car on the bumpy track.
"Mined out long ago. No coin now. Only darkness."
That might have been so, but the concentration of humanity was so all-encompassing in those other places that I couldn't quite believe there had never been overspill into what, in galactic terms, was right next door. I wondered if there was another reason. Something from the past, lingering in the arid grey soils, like a curse. The settlement slunk back into the dark as silently as it had come, its meagre lights quickly lost. We passed through several more of them, each as pathetic as the last. I watched the faces of the inhabitants as we passed them, and saw how similar they were to those of the Fellowship. No doubt they all came from the same stock, some dead end of humanity's great ancient scattering, washed up here and with nowhere left to go. Finally, we began to climb again. The ground car choked and struggled its way up a high scarp, teetering against the edge of a steep drop, before cresting a rise and coasting along a long, gritty scree slide. We shuddered to a halt, the engine taking a few attempts before it cut out. We dropped down from the cab, our boots crunching in the gravel. A single dwelling stood